We're going to take a pause on it. Not maybe entirely, depending on how kind of the course of the session goes today. Because I wanted us to focus on something that is relevant to prayer also. But in particular, seasonally, we're in a time of the calendar year where people go to make the pilgrimage to Mecca. The major pilgrimage is called the Hajj. In Sunni Islam, it's one of the five pillars of Islam. It's considered an obligation, and there's going to be a lot of different things relevant to this time of the year. There's a major holiday that'll happen next week. There's some other very specific practices, etc. So if you are coming to the class around Ramadan time, and we talked about the holiday that took place after Ramadan, so wanted to give an overview of it in that regard as well. And then we'll go into some of the Arabic letters again. People have been practicing that. So we can start moving forward on just like the reading and writing capacity. And then at the end, if there's time, we'll jump back into Fatiha.
So the Islamic calendar is a little bit different from the Gregorian calendar. If I also sound more monotonous than I usually do, it's because I just got off of a plane. I was in Portland yesterday and flew out this morning at around 6 o'clock in the morning, and then landed in JFK. And if you've ever come from JFK back to Manhattan in the middle of the day, it's not the most fun thing to do in the world. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. So I apologize for that. The month on the Islamic calendar that we're in is called Dhul-Hijjah. And it's the last month on the Islamic calendar. The next month, to give you an idea, that we'll talk about also in the coming weeks is called Muharram. This is the first month on the Islamic calendar. So we're looking at the last month on the calendar. So there you go. Did you just wake up? You look like you're so peaceful over there. I don't want to disturb you. Yeah.
I was waiting for class.
Great. So this is the last month on the Islamic calendar. And in this month, especially in the first third of the month, there's a lot that goes into particular practices, rituals, rites. The most kind of well-known one is what's called in Arabic Hajj, and this is essentially a pilgrimage to Mecca that Muslims are required to do at least once in their life as they have the means to do so. And the means to do so is not just limited to financial means, but also capacity. Say I'm the caretaker of, you know, a sick parent, and I have the money to go for Hajj, but there'd be nobody to look after my sick mother or sick father if I was to go, right? I have a baby that isn't able to go, a newborn, right? I'm a recently, you know, pregnant woman who just delivered. There's a lot of scenarios that means can kind of extend beyond just financial capacity, but financial capacity is a part of it. And one of the things that's going to come up in the course of a lot of this is going to be how a lot of these rituals in the month of Dhul-Hijjah revolve around the idea of sacrifice. Has anybody ever seen pictures of Hajj? Right? You see like the Kaaba and Mecca. People are kind of dressed in very similar clothing, etc. So people have been leaving for the Hajj pilgrimage from about a week ago, if not longer. Some people from different parts of the world will go like multiple weeks in advance, even months in advance. But what's happening is millions of people from all over the world, they're converging on the city of Mecca. And so just logistically, it necessitates people arriving as well as departing in a systematic way, because there's no way that everybody could land on the same day, right? let alone thinking about just the traffic flow of individuals getting to hotels, getting to different areas. It's a really beautiful experience. Maybe in a couple of weeks, we can look at pictures and things. The AV in both of these rooms is getting redone right now. Otherwise, we'd show you a bunch of stuff around it. But it's one of the main rituals within Islam. Like, you have to do Hajj if you have the capacity or the means to do so. I went in 2005 for the first time. I was 22 years old. And in 2019, I went for a second time where we took a group of people from the Islamic Center. And then COVID hit. And then last year, the Saudi government changed the rules in terms of groups being able to go from the United States and Canada. They essentially nationalized the entire process. And people now have to go through the Saudi Ministry of Hajj in order to apply and perform and get selected for the Hajj. And we'll talk about all of that. But Hajj is one of the things. None of us are on Hajj right now, right? We're all here. So we don't have to go into in too much detail. It's not one of those things that you have to know the how-tos unless you're actually doing it, right? And that's the way Islam functions on a practice level. So, you know, whether you're exploring Islam, you're a recent convert to Islam, you are born into it and you're trying to reconnect at different levels, things are not obligatory upon you. So it's an obligation to go if you have the means to go, but you're not obligated to know how to do it unless you're going to do it. Does that make sense? And if you're never in the category of people who are required to go, so you just never have the financial means or capacity to go, then you're not obligated to know something just because it's an obligation. You're obligated to know it if it's obligatory upon you. Do you see the difference? Right? And why that's important is because you might meet Muslims, right, who they were born into Islam, or even if they're converted to Islam, and they're going to just start piling information, you know, like do's and don'ts, this and that. It might not all be applicable or relevant in the kind of stage that you're in right now. So just because it's the time of Hajj doesn't mean that you're supposed to just learn everything around Hajj as a requirement, and that there's somehow inadequacy or deficiency in your practice if you don't know the rulings relevant to something, because that's not how Islam functions on a practice level. You're only required to know it when it becomes required for you to actually perform it. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. So what is going to come from here also are a few other things that I'm going to write. There's a holiday that's going to come. It's called Eid al-Adha, and a part of this holiday has a practice that's called the Udhiya. Some people will also call this Qurbani. After Ramadan, we have a holiday that's called Eid al-Fitr, right? And some of you were here when we celebrated it. Eid al-Adha and Eid al-Fitr are both holidays that are celebrated after a period of time in which people who are Muslim engage in a lot of deep religious practice. So Eid al-Fitr is a holiday that comes after a month of fasting, right? And within that, people are giving charity, people are standing into the night in prayer, and at the culmination of it, there's going to be this holiday that takes place. And similar to Eid al-Adha, at Eid al-Fitr, you have the charity that's given that serves two roles, right? It's called the Zakat al-Fitr, that serves as a remedy for any deficiencies in your practice in Ramadan, but also as a mechanism through which those who don't have so much, they're now given financial capacity to also celebrate the holiday, right? The Udhiyah has that same concept. And Eid al-Adha is on the 10th day of Dhul-Hijjah. And the month of Dhul-Hijjah started on Monday. So today is the third day of Dhul-Hijjah. How it's relevant or similar to Ramadan in some capacity is that the entire first 10 days of this month of Dhul-Hijjah are days that are considered to be deeply auspicious and sacred. So there's a chapter in the Quran that's called Al-Fajr, the dawn, and in that Allah takes oath by these 10 days. Right, in Islam as a religion, individual is only allowed to swear by God if they swear by anything. But God is the creator of all things, is able to take oath by his creation. And what the commentators of the Quran say is that when God has taken an oath by something in his creation, he's giving an indication that it's something that's really important. And there's a lot of meanings and lessons that are drawn from the oaths in relation to the chapter that follows it. There's usually a commonality that's there. So in this chapter, that's called Al-Fajr, the second thing that God takes oath by, that Allah takes oath by, he says, وَلَيَالٍ أَشْر, by 10 nights. And what they say is that those 10 nights are in reference to these first 10 days of Dhul-Hijjah. And they're said to be the 10 days that are the most sacred days. And good actions, doing good works, are more emphasized to be done in these 10 days. So the same way Ramadan has 30 days of fasting that's obligatory for people who have the capacity to fast. It's got charities that are recommended, that are obligated, unique prayers that are recommended, all of those things. And at the culmination of it, you have this holiday. Within these days of Dhul-Hijjah, you have 9 days that also have recommended practices to them. And at the end of those 9 days, there's this holiday that brings in that social cohesion practice, the way in Ramadan you give a charity at the end of the month so that people in need can celebrate. And the end of these 10 days, following the Eid prayer, there's this thing that's called the Udhiyah, the Qurbani, that's a ritual sacrifice in commemoration of the Abrahamic narrative, where the Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, is commanded to sacrifice his son. In the Islamic narrative, it's his son Ishmael. In the Judeo-Christian narrative, it's said to be Ishaq, Isaac, but it's a very similar narrative. There are differences in it that we could talk about, but the Udhiyah is a commemoration of that, that Abraham is asked to or commanded to sacrifice his son, and in this ultimate sense of sacrifice, where he moves forward to do it, Allah sends a ram down in place of his son, and then the ram is sacrificed. And so what Muslims do around the world is they perform this udhiyah and they distribute the meat to people in need so that they're able to have access to that. One share of a udhiyah, you know, it depends. If you could slaughter a camel, you could slaughter a cow, you could slaughter a goat or a ram or a lamb or a sheep, right? In that order of like what is best to what is like least meritorious, not kind of hierarchically, but why a camel is better, quote unquote, is because it's the most expensive and it produces the most meat, right? And then you trickle it down to the last animal, which is a sheep. A sheep is much smaller than a camel, do you know? But more or less, what you're going to find on average is that when somebody does this, it's going to help feed up to 5 to 10 families. I've done a lot of work in refugee camps and conflict zones. Some of you have probably seen photos when I've come back from trips. I was just in Turkey and, you know, the devastation there and all these kinds of things. I went to Myanmar twice, once right after Eid al-Adha in 2018 and once right before Eid al-Adha in 2019. If you're not familiar with the situation in Myanmar, they're experiencing genocide there, right? The Rohingya community is being targeted, and go into, you know, stories in detail. But the second time I went, I met a woman who, to not give too much at this time, and I might talk about her on Friday at our Friday sermon, but she asked me to pray with her. And we prayed for her husband, who she witnessed soldiers kill in front of her, along with one of her children, before they assaulted her. And we prayed for her two remaining children, 1 year old and 3 years old, that she walked for 20 days with, fleeing soldiers who chased her through the hills of her country. And we prayed for her countrymen, who she said the pathways that she walked on were just littered with the corpses of people who were Rohingya, right? We prayed for people who, when she got to Bangladesh, where the refugee camps were set up, gathered money together, because when you're a refugee in this camp, you're essentially entitled to a free tent and housing. And an official who was at the gate didn't let this woman and her children in, who had walked for 20 days fleeing violence, unless they paid him 800 taka, which is like the equivalent of $8. But she doesn't have anything. She's fleeing violence. And so she stayed in a dilapidated school under the rain, all alone. And the villagers, who didn't have so much, gathered their money together so that she could pay this man his bribe to get a tent that was supposed to be hers for free to begin with. And she said, let's pray for these people who gave me the money even when they didn't have anything. And then we prayed for people. She said specifically, always let people know who have contributed, volunteered, helped support. But let us remember that we're not forgotten. The people notice what we're going through. We made a special prayer for them. And at the end of it, I asked her, is there anything you would like anything I could help you with? And she said, we've been eating the same rice every day, three times a day, for the last 10 months. And Eid is coming. This holiday is coming. And she said, all I want to do is give my kids something different to eat. Maybe give them some meat. And every part of me was about to be like, I'm going to bring you anything you want. And one of the relief agencies I was with pulled me outside and they said, don't promise her anything, because we don't know if we're going to even have something to give to her. People back home, they might not do what they're supposed to do. You get what I mean? So there's real tangible people on the other end of this, right? And what Islam as a tradition seeks to inculcate within the individual practitioner is that the world is much bigger than you. Where and how all of this is rooted in the idea of sacrifice is that it's not about it being a matter of convenience, right? People will literally have nothing to eat, or their life is set up very differently. The entire Hajj journey, for example, which a lot of Muslims don't really do in its own accord, is not meant to be something that is when you have a matter of convenience, you're retired. It's when you have the means to do so. Two of my friends who I think CBS or NBC did a story on, one played for the Kansas City Chiefs, the other played for the Vikings, Hamza and Hussein Abdullah. They're NFL players, right? People watch football. They play in the NFL. And I don't know if any of you ever played sports in your life, right? And when you were a little kid, you know, if you thought you were really good, and everyone who played sports one day said, my dream is to play professionally. They actually were playing professional football in the National Football League for really good teams, the Vikings and the Chiefs, right? Hussein Abdullah, you could look him up on YouTube. He has a crazy pick six interception that he runs back for a touchdown. They're both really great guys. They made the difficult decision. It wasn't easy to take an entire season off so that they could fulfill the Hajj. And when you play at that level, you risk. The idea is that if you take the year off, somebody might not invite you back. They were good enough to play in the league, but they're not like the best of the best in that sense, right? Like Michael Jordan, he can leave the Bulls and go play baseball for a year and a half, and people will say, oh, he just took an 18-month vacation, and then they're going to bring him back to play, right? That's not how it works for most people. These guys went knowing what they potentially were sacrificing. When they came back, Hussein got a contract offer. Hamza did not. But the whole idea is that you're doing it in the frame of sacrifice, right? Abraham is willing to literally sacrifice his kid. And when you go for Hajj, you see people like this. When I went in 2005, there's millions of people pre-COVID going for Hajj. And the way that they are moving is like literally on top of each other. People are very close to one another. And if you've ever seen what's called the Kaaba, the black cube that is in Mecca, part of the ritual is that you're walking around it in circles. It's called tawaf in Arabic. We'll talk about it in a little bit. When you have millions of people doing this, everyone's on top of each other. And from where I was standing, I could see gaps in the holes in the tawaf. It didn't make any sense to me. And when I got closer to where the gaps were, they weren't actually gaps, but there were women who were performing the tawaf who didn't have the capacity to stand. So they were doing it crawling on their knees. And not only were they crawling on their knees, they had their infant children strapped to their backs as they were doing it. Because they literally packed up everything to make a once-in-a-lifetime journey that is the Hajj. They're not coming from the middle of Manhattan. They're coming from other countries in different parts of the world. But they recognize what it means to do it once you have the means to do so. Do you get what I mean? And the notion within this isn't about anything other than, how am I getting closer to God to it? In the Quran, when this is described, right? So in Arabic, the word udhiya comes from the word duha. This is another chapter in the Quran. It says, wadduha, by the morning light. So why this udhiya, this sacrifice, is called this, is because you do this in the morning time, right? After the Eid prayer. Qurbani is also Arabic. It's got cognates in Urdu and Hindi. It's got the word qareeb in it. Right, so the idea is that through this, you're getting closer to God, right? That's what qareeb means, right? If I said that, you know, this is close to me, right? I'd use that word, like in actual proximity. Do you know what I'm saying, right? So that's what the base of this is. But it's being done in a place where there's kind of a sense of, it's not about like the ease and convenience of it. Do you know? And it's embedded in the Abraham narrative within the Islamic tradition that the Prophet Abraham, he gets visions that are repetitive of this. And his son Ismail, in the Islamic tradition, now comes and asks him, what's going on with you? And the Prophet Abraham tells him what's happening, and he doesn't know what to do. There's a sense of kind of, you know, what direction do I go in? He loves his son. And his son is the one that says to him, if God is telling you to do something, then you should do it. And it gives him that affirmation that he needs. And this is where then the ram is sent down. And what the Quran says about this as a practice is that it's not a practice that's about the slaughter, right? It's a means to give people in need like food, that's like a primary goal. There's also understanding that the companions of the Prophet, they would keep some for themselves, they would give some to their neighbors, whether their neighbors were Muslim or not. There was a companion by the name of Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As. When he would go to the person that was carving up the meat, he would say, break it into thirds. And the first third, he would say, give it to my Jewish neighbor. But here, a big part of it still, though, is to give it to people who don't have anything, right? And so, in that sense of an Abrahamic narrative, it's built upon this idea of that kind of struggle. Like, that's what the Hajj is. It's not, hey, everything else is done. I raised my kids. I retired. And now I'm going to go because I got nothing else to do. But it's in the sense of, hey, what really am I choosing between here? And what's going to demonstrate a choice that is in the direction of what God is asking me to do versus what it is that I just feel or I think I should do, right? And that's why the chapter of the Quran that we've been memorizing and looking at, Surah Fatiha, is important to understand, because it's really easy to get lost when you haven't consciously formulated an understanding of who God is to you fundamentally, or who is God telling us he is through the Quran and through the prophetic tradition. Then it can just be about do's and don'ts, rights and wrongs. And what the Quran says is that the sacrifice has nothing to do with the actual animal in terms of God, because God is the creator of the animal to begin with, right? Just like it says in the chapter we were looking at the last few weeks that we're memorizing for the necessary actions of our prayer, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, that God is the Lord of all of the worlds, right? So what the Quran says is that it's not like the flesh of this animal, the blood of this animal, any of that stuff that's going to God. But what the verse says is that it's about the taqwa, the piety of the person, that their consciousness, their awareness, that is essentially a mindfulness rooted in an ethical imperative. It's not morally relative, but it's relative to a God-centricity, right? God is asking me to do it. That's why I'm going to get it done. And the two things go hand in hand, do you know? Whether we think about women like the woman I told you about, the Rohingya refugee, who, like, literally, like, what is her life? What has she witnessed and seen? And this isn't somebody who's trying to manipulate something. She fled genocide, and she's sitting in a tent that isn't even bigger than the corner of that room with her two remaining children. And when I ask her, what do you want? She's still thinking about somebody else. I just want my kids to eat something other than this rice that we've been eating for the last almost year of our lives, right? And it can't be that we get to a place where this is not a religion that's about egocentricity. So it's telling you, think bigger than yourselves, even if empathy is the only thing that you can use, because there's no way you can relate experientially to what somebody is going through that has survived genocide, unless you are a genocide survivor yourself. And that there's a person on the other end that's going to actually benefit from this. Right? And a lot of Islamic ritual is rooted in this idea that it's not just about me. It's about so much bigger than me. Does that make sense? Yeah. So what's going to happen on the 10th day of Dhul Hijjah is people who are not on Hajj, they're going to, similar to after Ramadan, there's going to be a unique prayer that has a sermon attached to it. The prayer precedes the sermon. And these are days that you'll see a lot of people engaged in the recitation of takbir, saying Allahu Akbar, you know, tahmid, saying Alhamdulillah, right? Like the first word of Surah Fatiha. But the idea is that they're days of glorifying God and connecting to God, days of remembrance of God. It's a holiday. So where and how, like, we would love for you all to join us here, and you can come on Wednesday. We'll start at like 8 o'clock in Washington Square Park. How many of you were here with us or went to any Eid gathering after Ramadan? Not even just in New York, like anywhere in the world. Yeah, great, right? So it's similar, right? Like, conceptually, it's going to be very similar. You're going to wear, like, nice clothes, do you know? Be in a place where you go for prayers, like, hang out with friends, loved ones. People will celebrate it culturally in different ways. And it's very beautiful, like, our gathering here, because our community is so diverse. You just see people come in everything that makes them uniquely who it is that they are. We'll have a brunch afterwards and then a bunch of other programs that'll happen. But it's a day to like give gifts, to just be with friends and others. And that's the 10th of Dhul Hijjah, Eid al-Adha. Any questions on that before we kind of go into a couple of other things? Alaykum. So the day before it, so for us, this is next Wednesday. So the day before it is called the day of Arafah. And this is the 9th of Dhul Hijjah. Just a clarification point on the Udhiyah. You don't have to like slaughter the animal yourself, right? And it's important to know, I think I might have said this to you all, but maybe to reiterate it, we had a young woman in our community who was a new convert. She had converted shortly before Eid al-Adha. It was her first holiday as a Muslim, and she was super excited talking to me. I'm gonna celebrate with my Muslim brothers and sisters, et cetera, et cetera. And then I saw her like a week later and she looked really sad. And I said, what's going on? And she said, I looked up how we celebrate this holiday. And it said that I got to sacrifice a goat. And she said, I don't even know where to buy a goat. And do I kill this thing in my apartment? And she said, I live in a studio. Like, what am I going to do? And I was like, no, man, don't buy it. Don't. If anyone tells you, they'll sell you a goat. It's the last person you should talk to in your life. But don't kill anything in your apartment also. You can just have, like, you can pay to have this done. It doesn't have to be done in a locale. It can be done anywhere. We're running a campaign online that I think tomorrow we'll send out an email about. We're doing a toy drive also. There's a nurse in our community who some years ago started something that she calls Khair Giver. Khair means good in Arabic and in other languages. So as a nurse, she sees a lot of different people who are in positions of need. So in Ramadan, our month of fasting, she started a program to bring meals for people to break their fast and a meal before they start their fast who are in the hospital with like terminally ill children, you know, because they're still fasting, right? And for this Eid, she started to bring toys to children who are hospitalized, because they're still celebrating a holiday. And since she started, this is the 8th year they're doing it, they now do these toy drives in 25 states in the country. It's really remarkable. And I think tonight there'll be an email going out about the toy drive and tomorrow about the Udhiyah. The Udhiyah, like, you could do for $75, depending on what country you do it in. And the more expensive ones are $350, not because of just like the animal, but the country that they're in, right? So, for example, I think in Mali, it'll be $75. But if you were to do, I think in Syria, it's $350, right? Because Syria is just a big mess politically, you know, socially. You know, may God make things easy for them there. But you don't have to go buy an animal and kill it, right? Just so we're all on the same page, don't do that. If you want to go perform the slaughtering, which is something that you can do, what a person would do is after the day of Eid, after the Eid prayer, they would go to like a farm, and there's places you can do that in upstate New York, in Trenton, New Jersey, in Philadelphia. I've done it before. The first time I did it, I was, I think, 18 or 19. I went with my brother and my dad, and the animal, like, you know, started to kick me, and I said, this is not going to really be fun at all. So, yeah, it's what you would expect it to be if you were trying to slaughter an animal. So if that's not your thing, then probably don't do that. But you should try to do this. There are some opinions that say it's an obligation to do. In the Hanafi school, which is the school we've been looking at for the prayer, they say it's a wajib, like it's something that's lesser than a fard, than obligation, but more than a emphatic recommendation, a sunnah mu'akkada. And then others would say it's just recommended to do. Yeah. Before you do the slaughter. Yeah, so what happens, the Islamic slaughtering practice is called the dhibha, right? You also say the biha. Like everyone in New York knows the word halal because there's street carts, sometimes two of them on every corner, let alone one on every corner. And so there's different opinions on what constitutes halal food. Pork is categorically prohibited, and byproducts of pork are categorically prohibited. Alcohol, for example, also is categorically prohibited. You would have like the carcass of an animal, you couldn't eat, other things like that. But in terms of the slaughtering process, what the Quranic verse says is to not eat other, do not eat of a thing. Essentially what it says is that has had other than the name of God proclaimed over it. Right? And so the method of the slaughter is done by hand with a sharpened blade, it cuts across either at a horizontal, some people would say a vertical suffices, but goes across four main arteries in the jugular that yields immediate cessation of feeling, right? It's a very kind of humane practice of the practice of a slaughter. And at the time of the slaughter, the prayer that is uttered says, Bismillah, Allahu Akbar. It doesn't say, Bismillah, Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, right? Which is the Basmala. And we read the verse in Fatiha, Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim. Because you're still like slaughtering an animal, right? And so you could see what the challenge would be, that when you're taking an animal's life, that you would also be invoking God from the standpoint of mercy and compassion. So you're in the name of God, God is most great. It goes at the jugular, and that's kind of the prayer and the method of doing it. When you're slaughtering an animal, it's not meant to be slaughtered in front of other animals. There's a lot of understanding that the animal has a right over you. It's treated with care, it's treated with dignity. This is also supposed to not be an animal that has any defects to it in particular, that you wouldn't slaughter an animal that you wouldn't eat yourself when you're giving it to someone in need, right? So if an animal doesn't have a hoof, for example, it's got some kind of challenge or issue. It's supposed to be like the best kind of well-aged, you know, kind of animal when it's being done for the udhiya, for the qurbani in particular. And yeah, I mean, so essentially that's what it is. Bismillah, Allahu Akbar.
Yeah, I was thinking about more about if they say this is for the person who has...
Yeah, it's supposed to have the intention of the person's name along with it. Yeah. There's some concessions that are made when you're thinking about this now globally happening with 2 billion people. If, you know, a percentage of them are engaged in it because they have the financial means to do it, as well as, you know, millions on Hajj that are doing this, but it should be done with the name of the person involved when you're doing the slaughtering itself. Yeah. But when you pay to have it done online, you're going to give your name, etc. And this is where the different opinions are, that each person who has the financial means would do it individually for themselves. Or, you know, you could do one on behalf of an entire family or entire household, right? And there's kind of evidences for both. So there's a prophetic narration where the prophet says, if you didn't do the udhiya, like you're not intending to do it, don't even come to like the Eid prayer. There's a hadith that says, right? And it doesn't mean like you shouldn't come to the Eid prayer, but it's highlighting the significance of it, right? That this is something you should do. But the prophet also finished an Eid prayer, and there was two animals brought to him that he slaughtered, and he did one on behalf of himself and one on behalf of all those who didn't have the means to do it themselves, right? And so people say, from that, you could do something with the intention of doing it for more than one person, you know? You could do it for your family. But, like, you want to give something, right? These two things go hand in hand. And it's, to me, like, a very beautiful part of Islam that when I was looking at trying to understand religion for myself and looking at various religious communities, spiritual traditions, the idea of, like, social equity in Islam was really powerful. And you don't have, like, holidays without there being built into the holiday a practice that says, make sure everybody gets to celebrate the holiday, right? It's not just about you, it's about everybody involved, right? Okay, so the day before Eid is called the Day of Arafah. This is the 9th of Dhul Hijjah. So for us, this is gonna be next Tuesday this year. It's not always on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, it's just this year. This will be Tuesday next week and Wednesday next week, right? The Day of Arafah is said to be the most auspicious day in the Muslim calendar. On Hajj, what's happening is that all of the Hajj pilgrims, they're standing at a place called the Plain of Arafah. And what they do is they'll pray the two middle prayers of the day, Dhuhr and Asr, together. And then they just find a spot on this plain, and all they do is they make dua, they pray to God, they supplicate to God. It's called Arafah. In Arabic, there are different ways to say the word know, right? So knowledge, concrete knowledge, is called ilm in Arabic, right? So if I say 2 + 2 = 4, you might know that concretely. Right? Let's not use all of you. Let's use my 7-year-old. If I go to my 7-year-old, hey man, do you understand that 2 × 2 = 4? And you say, yes, Baba. Like, I know 2 × 2 = 4. And then if I say, and that's ilm, that's knowledge. And if I say, show me you understand it. Like, show me you comprehend it. And if he can show me he comprehends it, and he has comprehension and understanding, that's called fahm. It's different from ilm. Like, you could know something, but you had no idea, like, what it is, right? Do you know what I mean? But if you get it, that's called fahm. There's a verse in the Quran that says, O mankind, we made you from a male and a female into nations and tribes so that you might know one another. And the knowing that it talks about is rooted in this kind of knowing. It says, li ta'arafu, right? So you can hear the same letters, right? A'arafa, ta'arafu. That's an intimate knowing. It's an experiential knowledge. It's an acquaintanceship. And the Day of Arafah is essentially about a Islamic concept that's called ma'arifah. And that's like a knowing of God, but an intimate knowing of God. Do you know what I mean? And on the Day of Arafah, it's just you standing talking to God. Like the way you would talk to somebody for hours, you know, if you've ever had that kind of relationship with anybody, and all you want to do is just talk to them. You're just standing and you're just talking to God, engaged, and there's millions of people who are going to be there on the Plain of Arafah, and they're just pouring their hearts out on everything that is going on inside of them. So what we would do who are not on Hajj is it's a day that is highly recommended to fast. So if you have the physical capacity to fast, then you should fast on the Day of Arafah. So if you're adult, meaning post-pubescent, you're Muslim, you're sane, it's not an obligation, and the same rules apply. A menstruating woman would not fast, just like she wouldn't fast in Ramadan. If you're ill, you're sick, whether that's kind of chronic or something that is just kind of momentary, you know, you wouldn't do that. But the rest of us would be fasting, right? If you're also a little kid, right, you don't have fast. You know what I mean? And the fast is the same. You should take a meal before the time of Fajr, pre-dawn meal. If you don't take that meal, it doesn't mean that you did something wrong. You could still fast. We're going to have a meal to break fast on here on that Tuesday night that you all should come to. And prior to, at like 6 or 6:30, we'll have like a talk, but also we'll get people together and make like a communal dua, communal prayer. Because that's like what Arafah is about. It's a day that is the day that is like very recommended to also just do what's called dua, like engage in supplication. Doesn't have to be in Arabic, I mean any language. It's just you talking to God, and anybody can do it, right? Regardless, you don't need to have wudu. You don't have to be like sitting in a mosque. You don't have to be a quote unquote religious figure. Everybody is entitled to talk to God. The day of Arafah is the most important day on the Islamic calendar that you want to make a note of it and kind of engage it in that way. Yeah.
So I was going to ask you, you said Arafah. So like you said, when people supplicate, you're getting to know God, right? So I'm trying to understand like, you know, the relationship of like me talking to God and that somehow I'm getting to know God through that. So could you like explain that, please?
Because if you're going to ask of anybody, like who else would you ask of? Do you know? So if you said to me, like, Khalid, can I have something from you? I like you. I'd be like, yeah, sure. Here you go, man. Right? But there's an understanding that you might ask of me something because we've known each other for so long that you might not ask of somebody else sitting in the room that you've never met before simply off of the variable of, like, intimacy. Right? Not just awareness, because each one of us knows that the rest of us is sitting in this room. Do you know what I mean? Right? You all have consciousness of that. But there's not an intimate understanding that would allow for me to engage you in that way. And on the day of Arafah, what's happening is we're just working our way backwards through the days. And I'll tell you what's happening with the other parts for people who are on Hajj. All these people will have been in Mecca for some time. Some of them have performed a smaller pilgrimage during that time. It's called the Umrah. They're getting acquainted and leaving like the remnants of the rest of things that are worldly. And it's allowing for like a more focused standpoint. So in Ramadan, for example, at the end of the month, you remember we talked about a night that was called Laylatul Qadr, the night of power, the night of destiny. All of these other spiritual vehicles arguably are getting you ready for these last 10 nights of Ramadan. The fast isn't about an empty stomach, it's about a full heart, right? You're nourishing like celestial parts of yourself, gaining in awareness and consciousness, you know? And you can see beyond the physicality of it, people start to have a transformative understanding of themselves and are able to do different things that they can't do during the rest of the year. Or not that they can't do, but they're not necessarily aware that they are able to do it. It's the same idea. You're building up to this day of Arafah, right? There's 9 days before the day of Eid. And so it's not in a vacuum. Other things are happening at that time. And now you're in this place that has a lot of blessing to it. Everybody around you is doing the same thing. This is why the fasting in these 9 days of Dhul-Hijjah are a little tougher than in Ramadan, because in Ramadan, one, like all the people in a non-Muslim world in New York City, like everybody knows it's Ramadan for the most part. Do you know what I mean? Most people are gonna have no idea. They're like, you're fasting again? What's wrong with you? Like, you don't fast now, you fast in Ramadan, right? So it just creates different challenges. But now when you're on the plane of Arafah, you're also dressed like everybody else, like everybody's there for the same purpose. Right, it's creating like a group kind of cohesiveness that also just yields a different type of focus and attentiveness. Do you get what I mean? And that's where now the opportunity for you to not like build intimacy, but to recognize what was always there to begin with, right? The Muslim poet Rumi, he says, your goal is to not seek out love, to seek out beauty. Your goal is to simply find all those things that you have built within yourself that make it hard for you to see it, you know? Because, like, Allah is always there to begin with. What gets in the way? Do you know what I mean? And in that place, on the day of Arafah, the pilgrims, it's just that much more apparent, right? It's undeniable, you see? And when you go and you experience it, it's one of those things that you have to, like, go through in order to understand. Do you know? To that extent. But for us here, it's the fasting day. So you should try to fast on that day. The Udhiyah is performed after the Eid prayer on the 10th and can also be done on the 11th and 12th of Dhul-Hijjah. And some people would even allow for it to be done on the 13th. You can pay to have it done before, which you should, but say you missed it or you forgot, you should still try to give on one of these other days because it'll still be distributed to people, right? Arguably through the 13th. So this is the 9th of Dhul-Hijjah. And then what happens for the rest of us, you're gonna have from the 1st till the 8th of Dhul-Hijjah are these remaining kind of meritorious blessed days, right? If you have the ability to fast, like, it's recommended to fast. It's a recommendation, it's not an obligation. You give acts of charity, you're helping people, volunteerism. These are just days to do good things. The assumption embedded within this is that they're days to do good things. So by principle of logic, it's also days that you don't want to do things that are not good. Especially on the day of Arafah, as well as on the day of Eid. The minimum understanding of things is, like, you want to fulfill your obligations, and for some people it's a little bit tougher than others, right? But these are not days that you want to, like, miss your 5 daily prayers. These are not days that you want to willfully engage in gossiping or backbiting. These are not days to, like, lie and cheat and do things that are all year round problematic. But you're creating a consciousness, like a certain sense of awareness to yourself. So how do they do this on Hajj? Is everybody okay so far? I know I'm saying a lot of different things. Any questions? Yeah. Nobody can be tired because I just flew from Portland, Oregon to be here. And none of you came from Oregon and went on the crazy plane ride that I just went on. Oh, man, I'm so tired. As you know, because, like, I don't know if it's because I'm getting old, but So I'll give you an example, right? I went to Portland, and I left my house yesterday. My flight was at 6-something in the morning, you know? And I flew, and I didn't really, like, realize I had a layover in Salt Lake City for 2 hours, and then got to Portland. And then when I got to Portland, even though I left my house at 6, and I've been on a plane for now 8 or 9 hours to get there, it was still only like 11 o'clock in the morning in Portland, right? And then sunset is much later than here. So when I left from here, I was like, oh, I'll just fast, you know? But with a combination of everything, I would have broken my fast past midnight in New York City, do you know? Plus, like, the combination of, like, flights and dehydration and whatever else. And I'm an idiot, right? So I don't really always take good care of myself. So I hadn't really planned in advance. Had I thought about it more so, I would have probably, like, done more in terms of just drinking, like, water before dawn, etc. So I didn't fast yesterday, right? It's not a problem. That's what I'm saying. Like, there's situations that might come up. You don't want to get so kind of embedded in the idea that if it's not done, it's the worst thing in the world. It's still just a recommended fast. And even in Ramadan, when you're traveling, it's one of the things that if you can fast, you should. But if you're not able to, traveling becomes like a reason for an exemption to it. Does that make sense? Yeah. So really quickly, what I'm going to run you through is what would happen for the people who are on Hajj. So on the 8th of Dhul Hijjah, what's happening is all of the pilgrims, they go to a place called Mina. So prior to it, you have Muslims from all over the world who are coming and like literally taking everything. When I went for Umrah, Umrah is a smaller pilgrimage. It could be done in like 3 days. The Hajj is done over multiple days. My friends and I went about in June of last year, and Hajj is last year was 11 days later than what it is now. Does that make sense? So it gets 11 days earlier every year. So you can do the math, right? It would have been in July. So we're there late May, early June, and we walked into the mosque, and there was some Indonesian people in the mosque, and they had asked us, you know, where are we from? We said, we're from America. And they said, oh, how was it for you getting here? And we said, it was super easy. You know, we filled out forms online, got our visa, health insurance, all this kind of stuff, booked our own hotels. It took us like 20 minutes. And we said to this elderly Indonesian man, how was it for you? And he said, it was so easy. He said, I applied 11 years ago for the lottery to go for Hajj. And this year, my name actually came up, right? And for the purpose of what we're talking about, it was a month and a half before this that he had gotten there to be ready for this. You see? That's when people start to come to get ready for what's going to be taking place 4 or 5 weeks later, you know, 6 weeks later, right? As soon as you have the means very much what that means. Does that make sense? So they're all coming. They've come from everywhere. They're getting settled in. And then on the 8th of Dhul Hijjah, which for us is going to be Monday next week, people start to go and settle into Mina. Mina is like this tent city that if you walk through it, it's really remarkable as people settle in. Especially after the day of Eid, which I'll talk about when we get to the 10th of Dhul Hijjah. But all they're going to do on that first day is just pray their prayers in the tent. There's a lot of time that you now are more conscious of when you're on this journey. One, because of the sheer number of people, if you're in a bus or you're walking on foot, everything just takes hours to do, even short distances, because there's so many people. People typically in Mina will be with other friends, family members, people of their own country. The way that the tent city is built is based off of the country you get your visa from. There'll be people who are giving like talks, religious guidance, you know, these kinds of things. And what happens in this is that people have prior to entered into what's called Ihram. It's got the words, like the letters that are the same as haram in it, right? Ihram, if you've ever seen the pilgrims, like pictures, men are all dressed in white, like two-piece towels. Women, their ihram is their regular clothes, but quite often they're also wearing like white or, you know, black, but it's really whatever their clothes are. This essentially is not just clothing, but it's a state of being. It's a mindset. And what this means is that you're essentially entering into a state where what is permissible is now impermissible. So they're not cutting their nails. They're not like grooming themselves in any way. You can't consciously or unconsciously be like, you know, pulling on hair off of your face, taking eyebrows out, right? It's also a time when you're not wearing any scented deodorants, perfumes, soaps. You can take a shower in the sense of like water, but no shampoos, nothing of that nature. And that's gonna last until after the sacrifice on the day of Eid is done. So for a good 2.5 days, people are in this state. It's also about being in a place where you're not yelling, fighting, getting frustrated. But the whole idea is that you are realizing that you are in control of you. So you are choosing your choices. It's not your emotions that are choosing your choices, right? you are very purposely in a place of presence and awareness that the state brings you in. You don't do this like when you're not on Hajj. Does that make sense? So what people would do is prior into entering the state, there are, you take like a shower, in which you would use soap and all these kinds of things, right? Put on perfumes and whatever else. Groom, get ready, you know, because you're now dressing essentially to be with God, right? And so you want to get yourself as ready as best as you can. But once you're in this state, like you're in this for a few days on Hajj. On the Umrah, you're in it just for the duration of the Umrah. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, when I did Umrah last year in December, they said you can use soap with perfume, but you can use it without. Is the same?
You can use unscented things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you find stuff that's unscented, that's fine. But you can't use things with scent on them, right? But the idea is that what's permissible is being made impermissible. So normally, you could use these things, but in this state, you can't. On the 8th of Dhul-Hijjah, when you're going in Mina, people are in this state now. And what they're doing in Mina is they're praying their prayers. They're kind of getting acclimated to it. Then, what happens on the 9th of Dhul-Hijjah is you go to Arafah. So following the Fajr prayer of the 9th in Mina, people set out to the plain of Arafah, and they're going to pray Dhuhr and Asr there. And then from there, after, they're going to go to a place called Muzdalifah. Muzdalifah, the Hajis, the pilgrims, they sleep there overnight. And they're gathering stones, because one of the rituals that they're going to have in the Abrahamic narrative, right, when the prophet Abraham is going to now slaughter to sacrifice his son in the Abrahamic narrative, Shaitan, the devil, comes to stop him three times. And each time, the prophet Abraham throws stones at him, right? And the idea for us to replicate these acts, we're replicating the acts of Abraham, his son Ismail, his wife Hagar, and embodying those through the rites of the Hajj. And so in Muzdalifah, you just sleep there, and you're also gathering the stones that you're going to throw at these structures that are meant to be representative of Shaitan. And then from there, on the 10th, after Fajr, you're going back to Mina. You're going to have like everything we talked about, because the 10th is the day of Eid also for the Hajis. And after they have like slaughtered their animals, they can shave for men, they would shave their heads. Women would cut a portion of their hair. You can now remove a part of your ihram, so you can put back on your regular clothes. And what's really remarkable is at that point, when you walk through Mina, this tent city, it's like very Lord of the Rings-esque, you know? It's like tents are built just in thousands. They're built into the mountains. But as you walk through the tent city, because it's divided by the country you get your visa from, you see just how deep Islam is as a religion. Because you're in the tents where people are from the Gulf, and the men are dressed in like white robes, women in black, they're speaking Arabic, you know, grilled meats, whatever. You go to the Indonesian, Malaysian tents, there's more color to their clothes, language is different, different spices to the foods, Indian subcontinent, you know, the shirts go beneath the knees and not all the way to the ankles, and there's more spice and different languages. African tents, there's a lot of purples and golds and vibrancy, also unique languages and foods, and you can apply it pretty much to every country in the world because there's Muslims in every country in the world. And as you walk through these tents, you see that Islam in China looks Chinese, and Islam in Sudan looks Sudanese, and Islam in, you know, every place, like, embodies the culture in which it's attached to. And what happens for us is we get people from all of those tents in our tents, right? Because America is not a homogenous Muslim community. Black, white, brown, immigrant, indigenous, converts, children of converts, people of every class, race, ethnicity. And when all those people go back to their countries where they have to figure out how to make it work and they're very similar in those outward senses, we come here and we have to make it work and we're all very different. But you can just see how beautifully deep Islam is as a religion walking through this tent. And if you've ever read like the autobiography of Malcolm X, you've not read it, you've watched like the movie with Denzel Washington, this is what he's talking about. Right, he gets to Mecca and he says, I've never seen this in my life before. It's not something that he's ever experienced, especially in a way where there's collegiality amongst people of difference. You know, there's a certain connecting point, because what's happening is not an erasure of identity, but an embracement of identity. And the connection is rooted in this shared aspect of faith, la ilaha illallah, that God is the creator of all of us. And when there's a God-centric understanding that we exist in a sphere of interdependence. And so on that 10th day, there's a partial removal of the ihram, and you just see how beautifully deep Islam is experientially, you know? And you're seeing it having experienced this too. Do you know what I mean? So think about like how different the world is when you go on vacation and you've rested and you're away from like annoying people at work and annoying people in family and annoying people that surround you. Everything just feels nice. And you can like, oh, the bird sounds so nice, as opposed to like, shut up, bird, I need to sleep, right? So it has transformative experience inside of you. So you're going through a spiritually transformational experience. And it's not that you get to a place where you're seeing something you haven't seen before. Sometimes that is, but you're seeing it differently, right? It means something different to you. Do you get what I mean? From here, you're going to have like remaining rituals, 11th and 12th, 13th, where people will still stay stationed in Mina. And then that wraps up the Hajj. And it's a lot of time where you're not just, you know, kind of taking clothes and like medicines, but what they say very consistently, regardless of what part of the world you're coming from, you got to pack a lot of patience with you, because it's just going to take a while to like get certain things done. It's not complicated to do, right? It's an act that every Muslim has to do if they have the means to do it. Things that everybody has to do or entitled to have access to tend to be very simple to do, right? But like I said in the beginning of our class, you're not required to know how to do it until it's actually something that you're doing. So most people, they get very kind of anxious because they don't know how to do it unless they're doing it. Do you see what I mean? So our hope is that they're kind of going now back on the decision they made last year to nationalize the process, and they're letting groups go again. So if that happens, you know, we'll start taking groups again, and then maybe we'll all be able to go together at some point. But this is kind of what's happening for the people who are there while we're here, right? And it's really like amazing experience to go through. Okay. Oh man, 7:18. So quick recap, right? If you can fast these days, fast. If you can't, it's okay. The recommended days. But you want to try your best. This is what, yeah, go ahead.
Do you fast on Arafah? Does that clear your sins for a year?
What the narrations say is that the day of Arafah, it wipes out sins from the year prior as well as the year that's forthcoming. Right? These would constitute like minor sins, right? But like anything that's getting wiped is good, you know? But that's what it is, essentially, right? And what is like the impact of that, like literal kind of erasure from records? You know, Islamic tradition, theology posits that there's two angels that sit on your shoulders, for example, at all times, writing down your deeds, right? Good, bad, otherwise. And so the idea is that from the hadith, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, says that on the day of Arafah, like fasting Arafah wipes out the sins from the year prior as well as like forthcoming. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
You said a point earlier, and I apologize
if
it's
like
a redundant question, but
did
wajib and fard, they're not necessarily
synonymous? Not in the Hanafi school. So in the Hanafi school, like the spectrum that's there has fard on one end and haram on the other. And in the middle, it's mubah, which means neutral. And then there's makruh, which is disliked, and mustahab, which is recommended. In the Hanafi school, this gets broken into tanzihi and tahrimi. And there is an added category here of wajib.
And so for something to be fard or haram, it has to have definitive text and definitive meaning. And why in the Hanafi school they add these categories is because there's a hesitancy to say something is actually obligatory or prohibited unless it's like absolutely understood that way. So they put in wajib and break makruh into two categories. So a wajib is less obligatory than a fard, but more so than something that's recommended or, you know, like a emphasized prophetic practice, where the text, the meaning can be somewhat probabilistic. Does that make sense? Huh?
So only applies to the Hanafi school?
In the Hanafi school, there's 7 categories that actions can be put in. In the other schools, there's 5. Yeah, so they would be here than that. And so the act of the udhiya is a recommended act in the other 3 schools. It's not a wajib. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Sorry, this is maybe quick. So the hajj itself is actually like 3 days technically, or is it
5 days? 5-6 days. Yeah. Okay. But after the 10th, you can change your clothes into like regular clothes. You can start using like scented products again, these kinds of things. Yeah, but you're still on Hajj at that time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, quick question. So if I was going to go do Hajj, let's say, like, I guess a week ago.
Yeah.
What's the minimum you can go, like, because of work and whatnot? Like, what is there a minimum you can go? Is it like 5-6 days?
Like, logistically, what will the Saudi government allow for you to do?
Yeah, I guess what's real, realistic. I mean,
I know people who left today, this morning.
Oh, nice.
And they'll come back on the 16th of Dhul-Hijjah, right? So, you know, when we were taking a trip, we had a package that was 11 days long, I think. But I don't know what it'll be going forward. Yeah. They're still trying to, like, work out the kinks on it and stuff. Did anybody practice the letters? The first 4 letters, Aleph, Ba, Ta, Tha. Oh, man.
I really wanted to.
You really wanted to?
Do you want my book?
What does that mean? Okay. I really want to write these letters today. I just wanted to. So try to do it, right? It's important because you don't want to get caught in us, like, adding more to it. And it's really amazing when you're actually able to, at the end of it, go through the process of reading something on your own. So those first 4 letters, let's try to get those down, and then we'll add more to it next time.